Look at this Frau Baerbock. I mean, she's a joke. There are lots of discussions in Ukraine, inside Ukrainian forces, about getting rid of Zelensky. They'd lost 400,000 dead. I don't know how much higher you have to raise that toll in order to be horrified by it. I've had enough.
Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich freue mich, Sie zu begrüßen zu einer sehr speziellen Spezialausgabe von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, anfangs September 2023. Exakt aufgezeichnet haben wir dieses Interview, das nachfolgende Interview am 5. September. Aber lassen Sie sich von diesem Datum nicht beirren, denn das, was wir besprechen, hat Gültigkeit über den Tag hinaus. Wir gehen ins Grundsätzliche, wir gehen ins Bleibende. Und ich bin hoch erfreut, ich bin auch hoch geehrt, dass ich Ihnen vorstellen kann, im Folgenden den amerikanischen Colonel außer Dienst, Douglas MacGregor. Douglas MacGregor gehört für mich zu den interessantesten Experten und Militärfachleuten in Sachen Ukraine-Krieg. Er ist nicht nur ein begnadeter Militär, er ist auch ein geschulter Historiker. Er kennt die philosophische Literatur, die militärische Fachliteratur und er ist auch ein dekorierter Schlachtkommandant, ein Experte, insbesondere auch der Panzerwaffe. Geboren ist Douglas MacGregor am 4. Januar 1947 in Philadelphia. Er ist ein mittlerweile in den Ruhestand getretener Colonel der US Army, ein politischer Wissenschaftler, ausgebildet in West Point, mit vielen Positionen in der NATO, zuletzt auch in der Regierung Trump als Berater beschäftigt. Und vor allem auch aufgefallen und herausragend sein Beitrag im ersten Golfkrieg 1991. Damals hat er mit seiner Truppe auf sehr unkonventionelle Art und Weise ein Panzergefecht gewonnen. Douglas MacGregor ist der Autor vieler Bücher über militärgeschichtliche und auch militärstrategische Fragen. Er hat sich auf diversen Kanälen geäußert zum Ukraine-Krieg. Er vertritt dort unkonventionelle Auffassungen, Auffassungen meiner Meinung nach, die es eben verdienen, gehört zu werden. Solche Positionsbezüge, wie sie Douglas MacGregor macht, sind bei uns Mangelware in der deutschsprachigen Publizistik. Und deshalb ist es eine ganz besondere Freude, wenn ich ihn gleich hier im Studio über eine Interkontinentalleitung begrüßen darf. Und nun freue ich mich, Ihnen das Interview zu präsentieren. Ich wünsche Ihnen viel lehrreiche Momente, viele Erkenntnisse und Denkanstöße. Reagieren Sie darauf, schreiben Sie uns, schreiben Sie mir, was Sie davon halten und kommen Sie auch mit Gegenargumenten. Wir stehen hier für Rede und Gegenrede. Jetzt das große Interview mit Colonel Douglas MacGregor. Well, Colonel MacGregor, this is a great honor and a pleasure to have you on the program of Weltwoche Daily. I have just introduced you in my short intro. Let's start it all off with my first question. Our media say the Ukrainian army has breached the first Russian defense line. They're writing that they're breaking through and that the Russians could get into serious troubles. This is some kind of the mainstream description of the situation. What's your assessment? What's your point on that? Are they breaking through the defense lines?
No. No. You know, look, how many times have we heard this sort of nonsense? Months and months and months, you know. Ukraine is marching to victory. You know, the Russians are incompetent, can do nothing right. I've heard this story so many times. And they're talking about Robotyna right now, which is the focus. Robotyna is almost as flat and devoid of people as Kansas in the United States. Whatever was there is gone. The most recent report suggests that the Ukrainians have managed to sneak into that area at night, but only in armored vehicles for brief periods, and then they rush out as soon as possible because they don't want to be targeted and destroyed by the massive strike assets that are being used to pulverize the entire area. So no, there's no significant advance there whatsoever. Secondly, whenever the Ukrainians have approached the first line of defense, even gotten close to it, they've tried to snap a few photos, photo operation, make it look good, show that they've done something, and then they rapidly withdraw to get out of there because they have taken so many casualties. Remember that the defensive structure is as follows. You have what we would call a security zone in the West. It ranges from 10, 15 to 25 kilometers, depending upon where you are. You have to move through that security zone to really approach the first line of defense. Just getting through that security zone has cost Ukrainians, what, an estimated 60,000 dead now during the so-called counter-offensive, which has absolutely failed. In this case, they claim to have reached that first line of defense. The principal value of the first line of defense is that it prevents you from seeing the second line of defense, which means that you then become an easy target for destruction. They haven't broken through anything. They're not going to break through anything. They don't have the wherewithal or the capabilities. Everyone who's looked at this, who's remotely objective and not on the payroll for either the major cable news programs or the mainstream media, will tell you we cannot break through these defenses unless you can eliminate the overhead Russian intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets, which identify and target the Ukrainians. Right now, persistence surveillance over Ukraine puts everything in Ukraine at risk. In other words, you can't go anywhere in that country without being observed. If you can be observed, you're going to be targeted. If you can be targeted, you're going to be hit with something. There's nothing the Russians can't target and destroy. We haven't been able to change that because we cannot destroy the overhead surveillance. Secondly, you've got to be able to counter the massive strike assets, which means you have to identify them and fire against them. Ukrainians can't do it. They don't have sufficient numbers of equipment. They don't have the ammunition. And everyone is looking at the Western equipment saying, well, it's behaving badly. The truth is the Western equipment is not bad, but it's in the hands of people who are unfamiliar with it. They're operating within a framework they don't know, and they don't have the requisite air and missile defense to prevent these forces on the ground from being destroyed. So the entire thing is a fiasco. Nothing is going to change unless the Russians want to change it. And thus far, the Russians have held 300,000 troops in reserve. They are moving very slowly up north and in the eastern part of Ukraine. I think they're going to eventually move further east and then north and probably surround Kharkov. But they're moving slowly, and they're allowing the Ukrainians to essentially sacrifice themselves in great numbers as they move forward up north. Meantime, the rest of the defensive line is intact, and the Russians are not rushing reinforcements anywhere. They don't need to.
How big are the Ukrainian losses? I mean, from this, we don't hear too much in our media. What are your numbers, and how do you make your own picture? Because it's very hard for us here in Switzerland, for example, to make our own picture. The media are always giving these victory reports, which seem to be a bit, as you described them, a bit off reality. How big are the losses of the Ukrainian forces? What do we have to calculate there?
Well, a few weeks ago, based on the reports that I've been getting from Russians, Ukrainians, Poles, and some others in Eastern Europe, some Bulgarians who are in a position to observe either directly or indirectly and are able to talk to people on the ground. I've actually had people call me on cell phones from Ukrainian hospitals to tell me how desperate the situation is. But I've tried to put that together along with the numbers of Ukrainian forces committed and then make an evaluation based on fresh graves that are being dug, announcements of deaths in newspapers, obituaries. And I came to the conclusion a few weeks ago that they'd lost 400,000 dead. Now, that's a lot of killed in action.
It's amazing.
Ukrainians have lost more people killed in action than the United States did during the entire Second World War. Now, stop and consider that for a minute. Americans have no idea what this is like. Then more recently, there were some advertisements about memorials services being held in Ukraine. And the initial advertisement said, come and remember the 400,000 who will never return. I think I sent you that. Well, not long after that came out and we had a chance to look at it, it was naturally removed. It had been a mistake. The Ukrainian national leadership got involved and said, take that down immediately, because they've been trying to disguise the losses. Now I'm being told the numbers have grown. Now, I don't know. I don't follow this every day. If you try to, you're going to end up losing your mind, because you have to sift through so many lies from the West, so much disinformation from the Ukrainians. And to be frank with you, the Russians don't say a great deal until something's almost over. So it's very hard to follow every day. I admire the people that try to do that. I tend to wait for a few weeks. And that's why I say this morning, I received information that the death toll for the so-called counteroffensive is over 60,000. If that's true, that would raise the number of 400,000 even higher. How much, I don't know. I don't know how much higher you have to raise that toll in order to be horrified by it. I've had enough. I see no point in this. The problem is, and this is very important for your listeners to understand, I think President Putin has always objected to any operation that would essentially destroy more Ukrainian lives unnecessarily. Therefore, he has been reluctant to unleash the offensive power of the Russian military establishment. He's held them back. That has conveyed the impression in the West that there must be something wrong with the Russians, because they've obviously annihilated virtually all the things that have been thrown at them. There's not much left in Ukraine. We know that press gangs are operating in Western Ukraine to try and round up anybody they can find that seems remotely capable of carrying a weapon. At the same time, they're now pressuring the Poles to let their people come into Poland and arrest vast numbers of young men from Ukraine who've escaped to Poland. That's how desperate they are. I don't see how this can go on that much longer, but unfortunately, as long as we continue to provide weapons, they will find warm bodies to put against them. I would say until there's nothing left at all. That seems to be the plan of the regime in Kiev.
Have the Ukrainians still the manpower to continue, or are they using all their strategic reserves? Are they running out of personnel? What is your take there?
Well, that's my point. If you go into the Carpathians, where villages are now being raided for manpower, because we see a lot of evidence that the Ukrainians have tried very hard to rely principally on people from rural areas as opposed to urban areas. And then secondly, they've tried to drain the coffers, if you will, in eastern Ukraine first before they stripped out the West. The problem is there have been millions and millions of Ukrainians that have rapidly left the country. Right now, they try to seal the borders. No one gets in and out without being thoroughly checked. No man of military age between, I would say, 16 and 60 is allowed to leave the country under any circumstances. And more recently, the Russians reported the capture of a 71-year-old Ukrainian man who was part of a tank crew that was opposing the Russians. I think they're already scraping the bottom of the barrel. They no longer have any standards. They tried to empty the prisons. They're bringing people on board, I'm told, who have mental problems, who are psychiatrically incapable. I mean, this is a tragedy beyond anything that we in the West can imagine. And naturally, I think if more people in Germany and Switzerland and Austria and other Western countries knew the truth, they would demand an end to this.
But isn't it totally irresponsible for a leader of a country like President Zelensky, who is hailed like a saint, even in Switzerland, in our parliament, isn't it totally responsible to sacrifice so many lives in a military operation in a war where you are saying it's absolutely impossible to win? The Russians are just too strong. Their defenses are too strong. Isn't that utterly irresponsible from a political standpoint?
Well, of course, but we have experience with this. We saw Stalin throw millions and millions and millions of lives away. We know that he executed 1 million Soviet soldiers who refused to fight against the Germans. Mm-hmm. At least 15 million Soviet soldiers were killed, and another 13 to 14 million civilians died. Stalin was a mass murderer on the same scale. We haven't seen that yet, but there's not much difference between him and Zelensky. The interesting thing about Hitler is that most of the heaviest losses occurred in the last 6 to 12 months of the war, mm-hmm. when he seems to have decided to throw away life without compunction. But I don't think we've seen anything like this since probably Pol Pot in mm-hmm. Cambodia. This is a criminal. There's no question about it. But he was picked by this oligarch Kolomoisky, who's now supposedly being arrested for corruption, which seems a little late in the game. But Kolomoisky picked him, groomed him, and essentially installed him as president. Remember, Zelensky ran on a platform of peace and then rapidly turned in the opposite direction. This is a tragic set of circumstances, but one can only assume that Zelensky is doing what the people in Washington and London and probably Paris want him to do. I'm told he has to be guarded 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. There are lots of discussions in Ukraine, inside Ukrainian forces, about getting rid of Zelensky.
How do you explain the coverage of our media? I mean, they're so far away from these kind of analysis. They're still in some kind of victory mode. Well, somehow you see one or two articles in our media saying, well, the offensive is not going as well as expected. But what's your comment on the coverage of our mainstream media?
I urge everyone who asks the same question in the United States to look at the people who own the media, the people that control the financial system, the people at the top of the government. Who are they? Where did they come from? We have a ruling political class in this country that has emerged over the last 20 years. They've always been with us, but they've never been in power as they are right now. That is probably the most radically leftist elite that we've ever had. The so-called Republicans are at best controlled opposition. And those people listening to this who understand what the communist regimes were like in Eastern Europe will appreciate what that means. You in Europe have to do the same thing. Who are the people with the financial power to build up governments with their favored personalities, the people they like? Where are the people who have been governing you for the last 25, 30 years coming from? What do they represent? I think you're dealing with another class of people that emerged during the post-war years with a set of attitudes and values. And they're also beholden, I would argue, to many of the same people that ours are. Mm-hmm. You have not just domestic or national oligarchs with billions of dollars or euros at their disposal. You have international figures. These people are very difficult to defeat because they can buy up politicians, buy up political support. And in Washington, people are reluctant to tell the truth and to move to a different position until they see absolute evidence that the people that put them where they are can't harm them. In other words, people are afraid. But look what happens in much of Europe. You stand up and say, well, I think this war in Russia is wrong. Well, you know, why? We have to destroy Russia. And somebody says, why? Mm-hmm. Well, Russia's evil. Well, why? It's not communist. Well, it's bad. Well, why? And you get the same thing. Well, if you talk like this, you have to be censored. In England, they're talking about putting people in jail. I mean, it's incomprehensible. Talk about free speech. It's the antithesis of it. One wonders why we bothered fighting the last world war. It's appalling. So I can't tell you these five people are responsible in Germany or Switzerland or France. I'm telling you and the people listening, go find out who's bankrolled by whom. My experience is follow the money. If you follow the money, you'll get an answer.
How deep are the Americans involved in this war? Are they totally into it? Is Zelensky actually taking orders from Washington? How deeply are they involved?
Well, first of all, the average American is completely disinterested. Mm-hmm. I would argue the average American may or may not know very much about this thing called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. Americans aren't even aware of the numbers of troops that we have on the ground today in Poland and Romania, or in the Baltic littoral. Most Americans are concerned with their lives here in the United States. So let's separate the electorate, the majority of Americans who vote, from the government. The government is completely without accountability. They have established themselves in power over the last 2.5 years. They think that they have rigged the situation such that they can stay in power in perpetuity. I don't think they're right, but I think they truly believe that they now control all the levers of power and they have all the money they need and everyone is going to have to go along with them whether they like it or not. So my point is that Americans are very involved in government with what's happening on the ground in Ukraine. And I think there are lots of American active and former military leaders, as well as British active and former military leaders involved on the ground. And they are giving the Ukrainians advice. And I think lots of Ukrainians have begun to question the validity of that advice. And when you push these people, they say, well, they need more. Next year will be better. I guess we can't win this year now, but we can win next year. Why? What leads anybody to this conclusion? It's sort of ridiculous nonsense. It just means more death and destruction in Ukraine. The question I keep asking is, surely Europeans are closer to the reality. They feel more affected. Why aren't they rising up and demanding hard answers? Well, perhaps part of it is because they're foolish enough to believe whatever the government says. I had hoped that 50 or 60 years ago, Europeans were cured of that malady. They don't seem to be. It especially disappoints me in Germany and Austria, less in Austria, because I think Austrians are now asking many of the right questions. And by the way, I don't understand why the Swiss have put their neutrality position at such risk.
I mean, this will be actually my final question. I just talked to a former NATO general who said Switzerland should stay out of NATO and should stick to neutrality. But we will get to that point at the end of our conversation. But let me ask you this about the United States, because they're absolutely crucial in this conflict. I mean, when the Americans decide it's over from the Western part. And the question we have here, also from a military perspective, do you think that the Americans will deliver these weapons, I hope I pronounced them correctly, ATACMS, we call them Marschflugkörper, yep. Cruise missiles, and the Germans are talking about those Taurus missiles, and Zelensky has promised, if I get these, I will not use them to target deep into Russia objectives. What is going to happen there? Are they delivering these weapons? Are you trusting Zelensky that he's not going to escalate the war deep into
Russia? I think
Russia?
There is inside the current administration a split in attitude. On one hand, you have people that absolutely have thrown caution to the wind and have decided that whatever results in the destruction of Russia is a good thing, therefore give Zelensky everything. I don't think that they hold the majority opinion at this point. On the other hand, you have many people who are saying, based upon what we've seen thus far, the Ukrainians will use whatever they have to attack Moscow and other Russian cities if given the opportunity. And I think they know that. I am hopeful that cooler minds will prevail. ATACMS are essentially the same as your MLRS multiple rockets from the HIMARS, the High Mobility Rocket System, except they have a much greater range, but they're equally precise. I hope they don't, because as you move in this direction, you begin to leave the Russians with no choice but to do what? March west. And I keep warning people about this. You know, supposedly we were here involved to stop this offensive Russian nation from marching west to reconquer Eastern Europe. Well, there was no evidence for that. In fact, the Russian army was too small for the operation it was assigned to conduct. Putin didn't realize that, because he thought he was simply sending signals to the West that would result in some sort of negotiated outcome. He was wrong. He grossly misjudged the reckless hatred that exists in Washington and London, I would argue, in particular for Russia. So now he's figured it out. But he's still holding back because he doesn't want a direct confrontation with NATO. I also think that he's watching carefully the economies, in particularly in Western Europe and in the United States, and the financial system. And our financial system is very fragile right now. I don't want to get into a lengthy discussion, but many of your colleagues in the financial system are well-versed in it and are watching carefully as our bond yields rise and the prices of our bonds fall, because nobody wants to buy our treasury bonds. So now you're talking about banks at home and banks in Europe and banks around the world holding trillions in U.S. treasuries that are increasingly worth nothing because interest rates have risen. And you're holding bonds that are just an anchor. So people at some point are going to say, we've got to shed these things, get rid of them. When that begins, the United States economy, and I would argue the rest of the Western economy, is in a lot of trouble. That's the tip of the iceberg. We haven't talked about all the other things. But I think Mr. Putin, who understands economics, is watching that carefully. And so he's saying, well, if I'm smart, instead of prosecuting this offensive all the way to the Polish border, I can wait for things to fall apart in Europe. If we have a cold winter, you know better than I do what the consequences could be in Central and Northern Europe. So I think these things are on his mind. But we don't seem to understand that if we press ahead and keep escalating, and at some point the Russians will say that's enough. We have no choice. And remember, this is existential for Russia. Ukraine is to Russia what Mexico is to us. What would we tolerate in Mexico? Would we tolerate Russian and Chinese influence building up Mexican forces to attack us? Would we tolerate their missile batteries capable of striking targets in the United States? Of course not. I can tell you the American people would go crazy. We'd flatten Mexico in a few hours without hesitation. Well, the Russians have been far, far more restrained than we would be. But that doesn't have to last. I think it's a great mistake to continue to pretend that Russia can't do these things. They absolutely can.
How close are we to a nuclear confrontation?
Russia and China have both essentially adopted a no first use position. The Russians will not initiate the use of any nuclear weapon unless they are struck first. And I take them seriously. I think the Russians and the Russian population have a far more realistic view of just how destructive those weapons are than we do at the moment. I think for some reason, people in Washington dismiss such a possibility. We have bullied so many countries for so long through our financial system, militarily, through our interventions. We don't seem to understand the dangers of confronting a major power that can fight back. After all, what have we been fighting for the last 20 plus years? People with AK-47s, command detonated mines, in sandals and bed sheets. We haven't fought any opposing armies or opposing air forces. None of our opponents have had any air or missile defense. We're confronted with something very different right now. We don't seem to understand that. We need to wake up and wake up quickly and stop pretending that we have an upper hand in this. We do not. And again, you know, it's back to the Mexico analogy. What chance would the Russians and the Chinese have against us in Mexico? None. And what do we realistically have against them in Ukraine? None. You don't fight your enemy on the enemy's doorstep. That's stupid. And we continue to do this.
I stressed in my introduction that you are not only a scholar, I mean, you have studied also military history, you have a great experience as a scholar, but also as a combat officer. So you're not just, you know, I mean, you had the experience in real combat in the first Gulf War. And as I read, with unconventional warfare, you have been very successful there. I mean, the question that comes up is, what happens if Ukraine really loses? I mean, if the army is on its knees, Zelensky is at the end of everything, will NATO, will the Americans accept Ukrainian defeat? Or do you see a scenario where NATO will then move in, or NATO states like Poland, that they will not accept Ukrainian defeat?
Well, if you look at the polls that are underway in Europe right now, particularly in Poland, the Polish electorate's opinion has changed dramatically over the last few months. At some point, they were, you know, more than 68% willing to directly engage in the war if necessary. Today, 56% of Poles who are voters in Poland have said, well, we'll continue to support the Ukrainians, but we will not under any circumstances intervene in Western Ukraine with Polish troops. The Poles have an election on the 15th of October. I have a feeling that we're going to learn a great deal from that election, and this current government that has been prosecuting this war against Russia and Ukraine may find itself in a very fragile position. My point is, I think the European electorates have begun to say, we really don't want to go to war with Russia. So why are you going to war with Russia? It has not yet caught up with Chancellor Scholz, whose approval rating at this point is about 31%. But I suspect on the current track, if the Germans continue on the current track with their government, he won't last. I think Mr. Macron is in a very weak position right now. I'm surprised he's still there. And that has to do with more than just the Russia issue, but with domestic problems. And I think the domestic problems in all the West European countries are going to grow worse as a result of the economy and the oil and gas problem, the energy problem. So my view is, I think the Europeans, if they elect the right people and put them in power, can end this thing. Mm-hmm. But Washington won't. Mm-hmm. No one in Washington is prepared to stand up and say, well, you know, we were wrong. We misjudged Russia. Our underlying assumptions were wrong. Russia is not just a gas station with nuclear weapons. Russia is a rich and powerful state, rich in resources, has the best technology, has excellent weaponry, has good forces. Its population is firmly behind its government. So I think in our case, no one will say that. And so they would rather let it drag on and drag on and drag on. And at some point, they'll change the subject here. That's what happened to us in Vietnam.
Yeah.
I mean, I lived through that. Suddenly we stopped talking about Vietnam and everybody said, what happened to Vietnam? I often ask people, what happened to the global caliphate? Oh, well, that's gone. Now Russia's number one. Well, wait a minute now. Russia's not the big problem. It's really China. China, that's the problem. I think you're going to hear more of that nonsense. We have a bad habit of behaving this way. Remember, we're a maritime power historically, like the British. Mm-hmm. We sail into the place. We do things. And when things go badly for us, we sail home. Yeah. You live there. Remember what Charles de Gaulle said. The problem for Europe is Britain is an island and Americans don't live in Europe. That's still a huge problem. Mm-hmm. You need to wake up. That's the problem with all these alliance structures.
Yeah. And we see now that some kind of blame game seems to have started also from Washington, people saying Zelensky is not doing a good job. I talked to Viktor Orban recently. I asked him, what is the main lesson you took from this war? And he said to me, well, the main lesson is that Europe doesn't exist. Europe has just vanished from the stage. We do not exist anymore. It's a terrible experience. What is the most important lesson you took out of this war so far?
Well, it's interesting that Orban made the comment he did, because I think it was in the 1870s, Gorshakov, who was the foreign minister for the Tsar at the time, sent a letter to along with a document for his inspection to Chancellor Bismarck. Mm-hmm. And Bismarck, and the note said, what happened to the concert of Europe? He was decrying the fact that all Europeans were not united and so forth. And Bismarck wrote in the margins, what is the concert of Europe? Right? Europe has never been Europe. Europe breaks down. And I grow so tired of this. I remember sitting in Vienna, listening to enthusiastic Austrians extolling the virtues of the euro, and the euro would be a big success, and Europe was going to be united on and on and on back in 1998, 1999. And I said, well, you have different cultural spheres. The view from Berlin is not the same as the view from Madrid. The view from Rome is different from the view in Berlin. The view from Stockholm is closer to Berlin's view. Mm-hmm. Now, the point is, I see Europe breaking down into different security zones. When I was at Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, we once concluded that there was only one unifying force in the NATO alliance. That was almost universal dislike of France, because it was no longer an enemy in Russia. I mean, I think people are unrealistic in Europe to think that these things don't matter. Culture, religion, ethnicity, language, all of these things are meaningful. Mm-hmm. We have tried to paper it over. And unfortunately, many of you have tried to imitate us. And I think that's gotten you into a lot of trouble. You're Europeans. You are not the United States of Europe. You're not Americans. Mm-hmm. We, on the other hand, I think have not learned anything. We are beginning to have a groundswell of support in the electorate for what I would call non-intervention. People are beginning to say, well, wait a minute, why are we doing this? We intervened in Vietnam. That didn't work out well. We intervened all over the Middle East. The place is a disaster. Everywhere we go, we create conditions that are worse than the ones that we found. Countries that were formerly either disinterested in us or neutral have now become enemies. So why are we doing this? That hasn't hit Washington yet. I think when we go through our financial crisis again, which I think is going to be much worse than 2008, you will see more and more of that in the United States. This business of interventionism is an unnatural thing for us. We are an empire from the Atlantic to the Pacific. We don't need anything else. And that was the view very early in our history. I think we're going to go back to that. But thus far, the government in Washington has learned nothing. But the clear strategic lesson is, if you don't have to fight 6, 7, 8,000 miles from home, don't do it. I mean, that's common sense.
Common sense. Let's talk about ending the war, Colonel McGregor. There's a famous quotation, of course, everybody knows, but everybody forgets all the time. The famous quotation, of course, is Karl von Clausewitz. War is the continuation of politics by other means, meaning that every war has a political root cause, which has to be addressed when you want to end the war. So what is, according to you, the crucial political root cause of this war we have to keep in mind in order to end this war and to find a peace with stability?
Well, first, if you'll allow me just a modest correction. In German, Clausewitz wrote, mit anderen Mitteln.
Right.
We say by other means. It's the wrong translation.
Okay.
I is very different from with. Mm-hmm. So he said with other means, and he was right. War does continue with other means that, you know, that's always there. Political conflict is always with us. Whether or not you opt for the military solution is another matter. We are not going to resolve the conflict between ourselves and Russia quickly. We have lost a lot of trust, confidence, and credibility in Moscow. If you go back 30 years ago, I can go back to 2001 when I was in Moscow, I encountered no hostility to the United States at all. If anything, I encountered a great deal of relief that this insanity called the Cold War was over. And people that I spoke to very much looked forward, and these were senior officers in the Russian military establishment, very much looked forward to a better future. And if you recall, Solzhenitsyn said, the war between East and West is over. The new war between North and South is just beginning. Now, I don't really want a war with the South either, but his point was right. This is artificially created by Washington and its vassal states in Europe. War with Russia, it's unnecessary. Russia presents no threat. Now, Russia today is far more powerful than it was in the 1980s. People are beginning to figure that out. And this Russian military establishment is much better than the Soviet armed forces that I personally saw. These are very thoughtful soldiers, officers capable of taking initiative. All the propaganda you're hearing about the Russians is wrong. Now, how do you end this? The number one thing that has to happen is to suspend aid to Ukraine. Now, it would be best if we did that. We are reluctant to do it. We're reluctant to do it for many reasons. One is it proves that we were wrong and we've lost. Secondly, we don't want to do it because there are a lot of people making a lot of money by shipping equipment into Eastern Europe and into Ukraine and essentially moving cash from the Pentagon into the defense industries that also finds a home on the Hill. In other words, it's a money-making proposition, unfortunately, in Washington. But the number one thing is to suspend aid. A European power needs to stand up and do that, a leading power. And I always thought wrongly, obviously, that Berlin would finally step forward, because Berlin has always been the one with the appreciation for what was real or not real in Russia. A much more sober-minded analysis was always to be found in Berlin. It's been destroyed. Berlin is now populated by people who are as deranged, in my view, and unclear about the real world as the people ruling us. But that's what has to happen. As soon as aid is suspended, it's effectively on the road to an end. Now, you hear various people like Professor Mearsheimer, who argues that Russia wants a dysfunctional rump state in Ukraine. I think what Russia wants is a neutral Ukraine. I think what Russia wants is a Ukraine that is not hostile or an enemy of Russia, which is one of the reasons that he's held back the use of his military power. He may not be able to get everything he wants, but I think he could accept the neutrality, certainly on the Austrian model. That would work for him and work for the Russians. But again, that's something Europeans have to stand up and embrace and agree to negotiate. I just don't see Washington doing it. Now, it is possible, as I said earlier, that our own financial position has become so weak that our economy, which is already in recession, though no one in Washington wants to admit it, and could be in far more serious trouble next year, may suddenly say, well, that's it. We can't focus anymore. We have other things to do. Because at the end of the day, and this is what Europeans need to understand, there is nothing more important beyond our borders than what happens inside our borders. And if any American is asked to make a choice, do we control the border that Ukraine has with Russia, or do we control our own border? Everyone unanimously says we need to control our own borders. And most people are beginning to think we need to get the military, our own armed forces, back on our borders, which is where they were for over 100 years until 1948. I think we're headed that way, in which case the United States has no role whatsoever in ending the conflict other than to walk away. It will be left to Europeans to sit with the Russians. Then the question is, will the Russians listen? Depends on who shows up and what is said. We have never treated the Russian proposals seriously. We could have easily. Mm-hmm. We haven't. We didn't even consider them.
Putin is arguing he tried everything to prevent this war. And when I talk to my friends in Berlin, the media managers and the editors and politicians, they say, well, this is just Russian propaganda. We have to stop evil Putin. He's standing for autocracy. He's building up this autocratic state, putting opposition people into prison. We have to stop this guy. We have to make an example. We cannot let the Ukraine down. How would you argue with these people? I mean, they are very strong in the public sphere, especially in Germany.
Ab und zu mal habe ich den Eindruck, dass die Regierung in Berlin geistig abgetreten ist. I just don't get it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is where people have to stand up and question their own government.
So you say people should go on the street and do it like in the Vietnam War and say, we've had it, that's enough, we want another direction.
Yeah, I think they have to go to the ballot box too. And I think they have to demand new leadership. And I think new leadership is there. Whether you like Wagenknecht or not, and she's obviously too far to the left for me, she's essentially right on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the leadership of the AfD, they are right on foreign policy. The German government has made so many terrible mistakes that have done such harm to the country, it's hard to begin to know where to start. Mm-hmm. And all of this is coming to what I think is a very dangerous situation. Not only do you have the problem with all of these unwanted so-called migrants, I mean, any country at some point is overwhelmed and sees its own culture, its own way of life, its laws at risk. The Germans are no exception. You add to that the destruction of the energy sector in Germany. I mean, why would you just suddenly halt all your nuclear reactors until you had a viable alternative? In other words, all these decisions were made in some sort of fantasy bubble instead of looking at what was realistic. Why would you want to deindustrialize Germany?
And they do not want, and they do not want to investigate the Nord Stream blow up. They're saying if we publish the results, this would cause political uproar. So let's not talk about it. I mean, this is really a strange thing. Nobody understands this outside of Germany. Even within Germany, many people do not understand that.
Well, I think if, you know, first of all, I have not seen any of the classified information that would confirm or deny what Seymour Hersh wrote. I think Seymour Hersh is correct. I can't prove it, but I, you know, I know him. He has a solid track record. And I think the German people should ask the question, why would our ally, the United States, be involved in such a terrible thing? Why would they take such action against us? It's insane. Makes no sense.
Do you think that the American government, I mean, this government, I mean, there are so many Americans, and there is also, I mean, you have worked for an American president who probably would have taken a totally different course in this situation. But do you think, is there a political agenda in the United States, in some parts of the establishment, that they said, we don't want Germany and Russia to cooperate, the German know-how and the Russian resources? This will cause, this is not in the interest of the United States when Russia and Germany, Russia and Europe collaborate in that way. Therefore, we have to destroy, to blow up these pipelines. So they want to separate, divide et impera. They want to separate Europe and Russia. Is this a, do you see a political agenda, or is this a conspiracy theory?
No, I think there are many people that share that view. You know, and I've spoken many times in many forums and tried to point out that certainly for over 300 years, close cooperation on the economic level and from between elite classes, between the German-speaking countries and Russia, was ultimately a positive thing for Europe because it promoted stability and peace and prosperity. Now, the Poles obviously don't agree with that, but the Poles are not very objective about their own history. And when they go back to look at the partitions between Austria, Prussia, and Russia, they fail to acknowledge one simple truth, and that is that Poland was proving ungovernable. And the various powers at the time, however greedy for land they may have been, were very worried that Poland could be a catalyst for war between them. Incidentally, that's exactly what happened in World War II. So if you look at World War I, for instance, I know of very few Germans of any stature, and for that matter, of very few Russians at the time of any stature, who did not conclude that the war between them was a disaster and should be avoided at all costs. That's one of the reasons that the Germans celebrated the Hitler-Stalin Pact, not because they loved communism, but they saw a war there as a catastrophe for themselves and Europe. Now, that's a different world. World War II is unique in the history of Europe. I don't think that you could point to World War II as something that tells us about the future, but I think you can go back to the world that existed before Hitler and Stalin, and I think you can see something very positive there. I think the Germans need to reflect on that. We aren't going to reflect on anything. And the simple matter is that most Americans don't know anything about Europe, even those who have spent time here. Listen to the ambassadors that sit in your capitals, Americans, and some of the utterly ridiculous things they say.
I mean,
they know nothing about Europe.
The American ambassador in Bern said, compared Switzerland to the hole in a donut, which caused some diplomatic uproar. Before we talk about the United States and end our conversation, I would like to ask you, do you see a perspective that Russia and Europe could find peace again in the near future? I mean, one could argue Putin has no ground for trust after Chancellor Merkel said, well, you know, we didn't mean it seriously, those contracts in Minsk, we just wanted to buy time. So is this Russian, European, German cooperation model, is that gone for good or for a very long time? Or do you see a silver lining? This can be reconstructed rather handily in the near future?
Well, I'm many things, but I'm not a prophet. The only thing I can tell you is that the first step is to end this conflict, to stop it And that's where the Germans and the French and others must stand up and finally say, we've gone as far as we can with you, Washington. We can go no further. We're going to end this. This is not in our interest. It is not in the interest of Russia. It's not in the interest of the Ukrainians. I think that can happen. Now, how long will it be before there is a measure of trust and confidence? That's hard to tell. I would expect at least a decade to pass. But if you can make peace, end the killing, then there's an opportunity to rebuild the economic relationships. And as those expand and improve, then I think on a cultural, political, elite level, you can get a better relationship. But all of it really, as always in Europe, devolves around France and Germany. You know, the people, Metternich used to say, if Paris sneezes, Europe gets a cold. He was right. And I think a lot of what happens in Paris is very important for Europe. That's why I think Macron's departure is so important. Mm-hmm. But Germany is the keystone in the larger scientific, industrial, economic edifice that we call European power. Mm-hmm. So they have a role to play. So these two capitals will make or break what you've just described. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be encouraged by us to do anything. Again, for us, meddling in other people's affairs has not cost us very much. That's the problem. And when things don't go well, we walk away. We will walk away from this war in Ukraine, believe me. Yeah. I don't know how soon, but we will. The question is, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm.
I mean, still America, of course, is such an important world power. But America from a long distance from here doesn't seem in a very stable shape at the moment as far as the political establishment is concerned. It seems to be torn between two camps, between these people, I would call them the woke foreign policy hawks, the neoconservatives who want to make every conflict into a crusade. And then you have people like yourself, probably like former President Donald Trump, who are more realists, Republicans in the classical sense. Where are the United States heading? What is like in this process of soul searching or soul fighting? Where are the United States heading? What's your intuition there?
I think the electorate is very uncomfortable with the policies that have led to a drop in the standard of living here in the United States. We've adjusted numbers for unemployment 7 times over the last year. Our economy is not strong. The underlying fundamentals are not good. The stock market is not much of an indicator. I mean, in June of 1929, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, a gentleman named Mellon, told everyone in the United States, we live in an era of unbroken prosperity. And a few months later, everything collapsed. Now, not everything immediately, but that was the beginning of a larger collapse that then stretched into the 1930s. I think Americans are once again very focused on what happens at home. And the people that are sitting on the Hill right now are finding it increasingly difficult to justify vast sums of money going to this war in Ukraine, or for that matter, going into the pockets of 2.3 million illegal border crossers, because we are now paying them on a monthly basis $2,200. And the average retiree in the United States who's paid into the Social Security Fund all of his life only receives $1,400 a month. And these migrants or illegal border crossers, as we prefer to call them, are also getting free health care, free housing, whatever the government can provide. And we have people living on the streets. Poverty has risen inside the United States. Our educational system is in ruins. This is not going to end well for us. I would say that we are probably just a few steps behind the French in what you've seen happen in Paris and Marseille and other cities. Mm-hmm. When that's going to break into the open again, I can't predict, but we're not far from it. Those things militate against further involvement in Ukraine. And you can write off all this nonsense about a war with China. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. That is another fiction created by the defense community and people in Washington to keep the money flowing. Mm-hmm. Chinese aren't interested in a war. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. They've got their own problems. I hope your financial analysts are watching what's happening in China. It's getting pretty desperate in that country. People, China is not a Western state. It doesn't go to war because it has problems at home. It never has. Again, no one pays attention to history, culture, geography, people. It's awful. In the United States, we don't appreciate it. Unfortunately, in Europe, you've tended to follow that example more recently. You need to get back to basics and understand what you're dealing with.
Is President Donald Trump the greatest hope for peace at the moment in the West? I mean, I say that as a provocative question. I've never been one of those journalists in the German-speaking part of the world attacking Donald Trump. We published a different opinions, of course, in the Weltwoche, and then we defended him because everybody was attacking him. But I talked to a friend in Berlin recently, and he said to me, "Well, please don't say that I told you that. But for me, President Trump is the last hope of civilization." What do you say about that assessment? You worked for President Trump. Isn't he the man who could make peace with President Putin in the old-fashioned way in a very short period of time?
I think that President Trump could bring the conflict to an end by doing a couple of things. First is to suspend all aid, any more military aid to Ukraine, to withdraw or disengage all of our forces, soldiers, officers on the ground in Ukraine as advisors or support staffs, and to start removing our forces from Poland and Romania and the Baltic littoral. I think those things would go a long way to cooling this off. That's what the Russians will demand. It doesn't make any difference who's president. That's something that I know President Trump would eagerly do, because again, I know that President Trump wanted the Europeans to be their own first responders. What I mean by that is that first, be prepared to defend yourselves, and we will come and support you, but you should be prepared to defend yourselves first without asking us to come in and fill that void. So I'm sure that's the case. I think also Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is rising in the polls on the other side, is someone else very much like Trump in the sense that he would follow a similar formula. I think that if you look at those two men and you look at the support that they have, a majority of the American electorate wants to end the war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it.
So you had to form a great coalition between Kennedy and Trump. Would that be a winning ticket in the next election?
Oh, I'm sure that it would, but the probability of that occurring is very low for all sorts of reasons. Mm. And this two-party system is increasingly a facade. That's why we regard the two-party system as the uniparty, because the Democrats and Republicans, regardless of whatever they profess, are all on board with the same basic things. They refuse to defend our borders. They refuse to close the border. They think that they're benefiting from millions of people coming into the country that we can't employ, about whom we know nothing. They are convinced that we're benefiting from the disaster in Ukraine. I don't see how anybody could do that, but I think it's also because they're receiving huge donations from very wealthy forces, billionaires who want these things to continue. So I don't hold out much hope for Washington. Now, does that mean that Trump or Kennedy couldn't win? No. It's possible that they could, but it's going to be a tough fight. It's going to be ugly. And again, that's why I go back to Paris and I say that we're only a short few steps behind Paris. And I don't know when that's going to become clear, but it will be. In the meantime, though, as Europeans, you've got to take control of your own destiny. Mm-hmm. You can't wait around for good news to come out of Washington. Mm-hmm. So I would go back to your colleague in Berlin, tell him to grow up, act like a German.
And don't hope for a president in the United States. Do the right thing on your own. You mentioned Switzerland. Of course, we have to end this conversation on Switzerland. Of course, we have the discussion that in our country, in our political arena, that Switzerland should abolish neutrality or diminish neutrality, and even the membership of NATO is a perspective in our political discourse. You are an experienced army man. You are knowledgeable in history. You know Europe. What is your advice to Switzerland?
The first question I would ask is, has neutrality work so badly and prove to be so harmful that it should be abandoned at this point in the history of Switzerland? I think the answers to those two questions are no and no. So that's perfectly obvious. Then there's another part that the Swiss need to consider. Many of us at the beginning of this crisis were immediately pointing to Switzerland, Austria, and Finland, and potentially India, as nations that could provide forces that could go in and set up a disengagement zone, a neutral zone, if you will, between Ukrainians and Russians while negotiations were conducted. Switzerland has always been viewed as the critical player in resolving conflicts and crises. Its neutrality has been a blessing because people could go there who otherwise refused to speak to each other and talk. Why is it good for Switzerland to abandon that? And how is that in the interest of Western civilization at this point? I don't think it is. There's one other thing I want to say that I hope Europeans will think about. There are two great poles of civilization right now. One is Europe and the United States, that we collectively refer to as the West. And certainly the European part of Russia falls into that group, if for no other reason geographically. Then you have another pole. That pole is Northeast Asia, China, Korea, Japan. All of the nations in those two camps are responsible for probably 85% of global gross national product. They're responsible for the scientific and industrial advances of the last several hundred years. War between those states, those groups, must not occur because they could also destroy themselves and ultimately the planet, but that would leave the rest of the planet in a dark age. People need to begin to think in those terms and get out of this very parochial view that talks about a little conflict here or there between this and that country. It's much more important to the world now. And again, that's where Switzerland can play a role, by reminding everybody of that fact. So I would stick with neutrality.
Is NATO today dysfunctional or no clear mission? What's the problem with NATO? What should be addressed there? What's your opinion there with NATO?
NATO is originally devised was purely defensive. And it had no aspirations to global power or influence in the hands of these globalist neocon elites that now dominate the West. There has been a continuous effort to expand NATO for use elsewhere. We saw this happen in the Balkans. And that was a sheer misuse, in my judgment, of the alliance. And I didn't think at the time it was a good idea. I still don't. I would argue that any alliance that has 32 members is inherently dysfunctional. I don't know what anybody expects from it. If I were a Russian, I would laugh at it, because the Russians have the advantage of unity of effort and unity of command. There's no unity of effort or unity of command in Europe. So who are we kidding when they say, well, we're much more powerful than Russia? Really? I see all those Spaniards, Italians, Frenchmen and Norwegians, you know, suiting up, putting on their gear and marching east, don't you? Of course not. It's ridiculous nonsense. So, you know, this alliance, I think, is ultimately going to fall apart as a result of this conflict in Ukraine. Because, again, somebody's got to stand up in Europe and say, wait a minute, we didn't want this. We didn't ask for this. How does this help us? As soon as you start asking those questions, they lead to answers that are unambiguous. So I think NATO it'll die one of two ways, with a simple whimper. It'll just be a group of empty buildings in Brussels somewhere, or it'll go out with a bang. People will stand up and say, we've had it with you, and walk away. I think the EU is on a similar track.
And if you allow, as a military historian, how do you assess Putin as a warlord? Do you think he does a good job as a leader, as a military leader, and his operations? What do you say there from your expertise?
It's hard to tell yet. I think he has been, in my judgment, overly cautious, too deliberate. I think many of his senior officers feel that way. I think there is a worry in the senior ranks of the Russian military that if this drags on too long, there will be a tendency in the West to intervene. and on the wrong grounds. Well, what's wrong with the Russians? Why haven't they moved? They're weak. They can't do it. No, that's not true. It's Putin. Now, again, he's betting, I think, on what we discussed during the interview, that the economy will work to his advantage, the financial markets. He could be right. Mm-hmm. So until this resolves itself, we won't have an answer to your question. Mm-hmm. So I just can't evaluate it. I am worried, though, that, you know, if you don't act quickly to end it at some point, mm-hmm. you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And he's in trouble. His country is. Mm-hmm. So I think there has to be an end to this, but you can't end it at the negotiation table. Mm-hmm. If you march to the Dnieper River and send your tank columns into Kiev, then you have a shot at ending it. Mm-hmm. But if he sits where he is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I was in Moscow a few weeks ago, 2 months ago. I was doing some interviews, and it's like during the Iraq War, I went to Washington. I was talking to the neocons, and now I go in the other direction in this war. And it's the people I talked to. They were like intellectuals, even some media people. Even this guy Solovyov, the devil himself. I talked to him and to Alexander Dugin. So more of the conservative on the conservative side. It's exactly what you are describing. I mean, they're saying Putin, he has been a man of the West. I mean, he's from St. Petersburg. He was always full of hope and expectation. He has been deeply. He's now bitter. And he thinks they let him down, and they say, well, Putin was too naive for too long time, and Putin was not the strong guy. He should have intervened earlier. He should have marched through in 2015 when the Ukrainian forces were on their knees. So he did many mistakes, and in these quarters, they are rather critical, and they say it takes too much time. Exactly as you said before. That was an impression.
Only time will tell us, but yeah. They could be right. I share their fear. Of course, the other thing is that Putin, he wants to live with the West.
Right.
Some of these maniacs in Moscow don't get it. We need to live with each other.
Absolutely. But Zelensky cannot win this. I mean, Ukraine cannot win the war. Therefore, I mean, this is as bad as it is for Ukraine. Still, we can say this scenario that this war could drag on forever, probably not.
No. And the other thing is, if we try to instigate a form of guerrilla warfare in the West, the Russians will just crush the West. In other words, Western Ukraine will become a desert. Yeah. So, you know, we've got to wake up and understand that. There's no future for that. Mm-hmm. We don't want that.
Sure.
We want to get this over with. We want to live together.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Putin wants. Mm. And I think we should approach him with the same goal in mind. And again, I don't expect flowers to break out and music to play, but we can get into a better place. But I do worry about some of the others. I worry about people who could replace Putin, who are not
Prigozhin?
As...
How did you assess this whole Prigozhin and Wagner episode?
You know... An old friend of mine who's Russian, he said, look, Doug, these are just three mafia bosses arguing over something. Don't get excited. And I think there's a lot of truth in that between Gerasimov and Putin and Prigozhin. I don't think Prigozhin was murdered. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. And you can do away with him under much better circumstances if that's your desire. Putin is not that sort of person. So I think I don't attach much significance to it, except that I think Prigozhin, in his own way, was speaking for some of the same people you were citing earlier. And he's a hero inside Russia because they see him as the kind of committed nationalist that says, screw this, let's crush these Ukrainians and get it over with. That's all right, as long as Putin's in charge, because the crushing can be contained. The problem happens when you get someone other than Putin and the crushing is not contained, and it becomes a real horrible event. I think that's what he's worried about.
Are you existentially an optimist or are you a pessimist?
No, I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
I think we'll get past this. I do not see a world war ensuing. I think for all the reasons we discussed, I think our, for economic, financial reasons, we're all sinking. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going down on our various ships. This is a bad time to wage war. Mm-hmm. Russia is not. They have the advantage. Mm-hmm. They've insulated themselves from us. Very smart. Mm-hmm. And now I think we're going to see most of the rest of the world do the same thing. And I think our fiat currency system's in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't see a world war breaking out. And I don't, as much as I dislike these people in Washington, they are not insane. Mm-hmm. They're not going to push the proverbial button mm-hmm. and court nuclear catastrophe.
Do you take this BRICS development seriously? I mean, this is also a kind of a shift, you know, which is, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the United States, they say we are for the self-determination of peoples. And then those people have been enabled by globalization to have some degree of self-determination. They go together with Russia and China and not with the United States. I mean, it's a phenomenon. I mean, it's striking.
But we've done it to ourselves.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you've joined us. Mm-hmm. So you're on the same road into hell with us now. Mm-hmm. And we have been in this business of lecturing the rest of the world on how they should live. What they should do. The rest of the world's sick of it. They don't want to hear about it anymore. Yeah. And the other thing is, this is de-dollarization. Because if you trade in our currency, you use the SWIFT system, you go through our financial markets, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be screwed anymore. Yeah. I mean, the World Bank is just an instrument of our use. What do we do with it? We tell people what crops to grow, what crops to export. I mean, this is ridiculous. Yeah. The world's had it. You know, this was fine to some extent in 1960. That was a different world. We were all still recovering from the Second War. All of this should have gone away in 1992. Mm-hmm. And instead, what did we do? We tried to re-weaponize everything, hold it together, and then hurl it at everyone else. What a catastrophe.
Also in Germany, by the way, I mean, it's so much tension. So much tension is in there.
Well, look at this. Look at this Frau Baerbock. Mm. I mean, she's a joke.
Yeah.
She goes to Moscow and refuses to shake the hand of Lavrov, whom I have met. Lavrov is an extraordinarily intelligent, refined human being. Absolutely. He's always a gentleman. Mm. And I cannot imagine, you know, anybody treating him that way in Germany. But for reasons that make no sense, that seems to be popular. They have joined us in the kindergarten. We have this childlike view of the world that makes no sense. They've decided to adopt it.
Carol McGregor, many thanks for that conversation. Very enlightening and far-reaching. A great privilege, a great honor to have your time here and your wisdom and your insight. Many thanks. I hope we can stay in touch. We can continue the conversation in the spirit of friendly coexistence between the great civilizations, even though using a word that good old Khrushchev, I think, introduced into our language, but we can, as eclectics, we can adapt that too. Many, many thanks for your participation in this interview. All the best to you, and please continue with your insights against the grain, against conventional wisdom that we have in the media, in so many fields in politics. All the best to you and to the United States. Thank you.
Okay, same to you. Thank you very much.